Thank you for having me again at Dialoog. I'm very happy to be here. I'll pray for us just before I start the talk, because I need the prayer tonight. But I will just wait a moment before I do that. I've got a few intro comments. This is for me, Dialoog. I tried to count. I thought it would be 4.0, and then I thought maybe 5.0, and then I came to 6.0. Because Dialoog was at Rafters, and at Garsfontein, and at Magnolia Dal, and at King Price, and at Hatfield, and now we're here. So it's very nice to be in Dialoog 6.0, and the fact that all of you found the venue is really impressive, because it's been a really nice journey with Dialoog, and I'm very happy. Can you hear me clearly enough, Herman? Is it fine? Okay. So it's been a very nice journey for me with Dialoog. I want to also specifically just welcome my dad, who is here tonight. There he is, John Van Zyl. I've never ever dedicated a talk, but tonight's talk I want to dedicate to my mom, who passed away 10 days ago. To Linkie Van Zyl is who I'm giving this one to. For once in my life, I'll do a dedication. Johan asked me to do this topic, so let me be clear. This isn't something I selected or I chose. It's not something I would have chosen to speak on. He asked me to do it, and it took me 4 days to give him an answer, because I really had to think about it, and there's Leb sitting at the back saying, yes, we were waiting. It took him long, because I had to speak to Marianne first. The first thing I said to her, should a man speak on this? And we decided to try and do it together, Marianne and I, and I'll come to that in a second. But it's not just, should a man speak on this? This is such an emotive, but also existential subject to speak on, and it's something about which we want to be so careful when we speak about this. But then I said to Marianne, this is also something we both feel quite strongly about. It's not something we can avoid. We have to do this. And she agreed with me, and we decided to say, fine, okay, we'll do it. And I want to just say, I'm standing here tonight as half of the two people who should be here. But I've got a one-year-old and a four-year-old, and this is suicide hour. If you were to do Dialoog a bit early in the afternoon, we would all be here. But we want everybody alive at the end of the evening, and as a result, we had to choose who would come. And to be honest, it had to be me, because my little boy of one is very, very mommy conscious at the moment. So he doesn't leave her, you know, when the distance goes more than 2 meters, he starts complaining. And it could just not have been me. So Marianne, I've never ever seen her want to be at a place as much as she would have wanted to be here tonight. She really would have loved to be with you and to speak to you about this. And I can tell you, not one slide on this PowerPoint was not touched by her hand. You will see her go through this whole presentation, and she was an immense help to me in preparing this. I also would like to say that I think I'm going to try and be sensitive tonight. I'm going to stay away from sensationalism as far as I possibly can. I don't want to go there. I'm going to try and stick to the facts, but I also have to be thoroughly Christian in my approach to this. So although I'm going to be sensitive, hopefully, and stay away from sensationalism, you have to expect me to represent who I am, and that is a Christian and a Christian perspective on this very, very difficult topic. I'm almost certain that most of you have some sort of a view on the topic of abortion that I will be speaking about tonight. And I want to ask you to try and suspend your judgment about who I am or what a Christian perspective means throughout the talk. Try and listen. Try and give it a chance. You can have a chance at the end to come back at me. If I see people starting to boil at the back or in the front somewhere, I might continue speaking until 7:30. Okay? I might just go a bit slower and then run out. Because I know how contentious this is, and I know how much emotion this actually brings up. Hopefully, and please hear me on this, you will not hear any judgment from me tonight. I'm not here to present God's judgment or my judgment or anybody's judgment on anything or anybody. And you might only get a little bit of wisdom. I don't know if there will be any. Because this is such a complex and emotive subject. I'm going to try and speak truth in love to the best of my ability. But I can tell you my hands are sweaty because I'm nervous to speak to you about something like this in a country like ours. And I think that will become apparent as we move forward. I also just have to introduce you to my daughter in the left-hand corner there at the top. She's now 4. That was her first baby pic. Her first baby picture was taken at 12 weeks when she was 3 centimeters long. I actually have a video, but intentionally I'm not showing you that video because I don't want to be emotive or manipulative in what I'm going to do. But I can tell you, sonar has changed my view of what happens in the womb. Having been able to see it in live action was something really, really special to me as a dad now twice. So there is Annabelle, and that picture is way too big. She was much smaller than that. And you could not even see Marianne was pregnant at the time that that picture was taken. Okay, so next slide, please, Andrew. I think it's important to say that in South Africa, and from there our title, The Sound of Silence, that abortion is a very emotive and a highly debated subject in many places, but not in South Africa. When I started preparing this talk, I realized I have never heard a sermon in a church on abortion in my whole life, ever. I've heard talks at teenage groups where they talk about be careful to get pregnant, and then they speak about abortion, maybe a little bit there. But I've never heard a talk in a church on abortion, and I might be the only one. It's quite possible. But if you go to places like the U.S., this is a massive debate, an ongoing debate. And you will see that the two main groups that you find there both try and present themselves as being positive, pro-life or pro-choice. And if you are, in other words, not in that group, you immediately put yourself in the anti-group. It should be clear. If you are not pro-choice, then you must be anti-choice, right? If you're not pro-life, you must be anti-life, right? Can you see the emotion creeping in there? Okay, it's not two clear groups here who are debating a topic without emotion. It is a very involved thing. And I think if you have followed the news at all over the past year and a half, you would have seen some Planned Parenthood videos come out, and if you had the guts to watch them, you might have watched them and listened to what was said. But let me tell you, especially if you go and look at the debates out there, there's a shock and awe approach that sometimes takes place, where people take this topic and they make it a topic that is extremely emotive, and a lot of explicit things are shown. And I'm going to try and stay away from that. And the reason we are talking about this tonight, Marianne and I, is because we felt that this silence has to be broken in the church, at least. We have to start talking about the issues, seriously talking about the issues, if anything is ever going to change in our country. And not just about abortion, but about the related issues. And you'll see that emerge as I move forward. And I think the churches in our country have been completely silent too. Maybe I should ask for a show of hands. Who have you ever heard in a church a sermon, not just a little talk here or there or mention, about abortion? Is there anybody? Okay, my dad has heard one. Okay, but he's older than most of us, so he might have had a bit more time. Okay. Right. It is rare, and the churches are completely silent on this issue. Okay? I don't hear them speak anywhere about this issue. And I think what I have to start off by saying is that what happens is I actually, when I did some research on this topic, I looked at what the Constitution says in our country about the rights of women and the rights of people and of children. And then I looked at a court case that happened very soon after 1994, where a group of doctors tried to take the government to court about abortion. And the judge's decision was that human rights only apply to humans, and an embryo is not a human. That was the decision. Okay? It's not a person or a human. And as a result, those rights are not applicable. And I just wanted to say, I think it's really important to say that when humans are classified as anything other than humans, it's always bad news for them. Always. Okay? They're always in trouble when that happens. And that has been shown throughout history, and I'll mention that in a few minutes as well. And I think it's really important to ask the question whether a baby in utero is a human being or a person. And that's going to be part of what we have to discuss and think about today. I think it's also interesting to look at the inconsistencies in the legal systems of countries that allow abortion like ours. Just for interest's sake, this shows you the complexity of this issue. The best legal minds will tell you that if a baby dies or a fetus dies in utero, then that is fine. But if that baby is born and the mother dumps that baby in a pit toilet, as happens in our country, the mother gets accused as being a murderer, okay? Or at least something in that effect, or manslaughter, something like that. And there are many inconsistencies in that regard, but I'm not going to have time to point those out properly tonight. Now, before I get into the meat of the topic, it's very important, next one please, Andrew, okay, to point out and recognize the complexity of the issues in a country like ours. I mean, if we were to just put the topic of abortion on the table, I think it could be a relatively clear discussion, although we might disagree about the outcomes of that. I do think in this instance specifically, the context within which we live complicates this immensely. The prevalence of things like rape and incest and abuse and the high, very, very high levels of poverty, HIV, AIDS, all of those things mean we live in a society where life is not normal, and we actually have what I would definitely call an orphan crisis in our country. Okay, That means that in a country like ours, to say that abortion should be illegal or should be legal has other implications than just about the baby and the mother, or the fetus and the mother, or the zygote and the mother. It has these other implications, and I want to say I don't have solutions to these myself. Standing in front of you, I'm not standing here saying I know exactly how this should be solved. I do think, however, us as Christians, if you think of yourself as a Christian, and us as churches, and Dialoog is a church, must have some role to play when it comes to addressing these issues. Let me just illustrate, and I'm not going to go through all of these stats, but when we looked at the situation in terms of orphans in this country, next one please, Andrew, thank you. Okay, so that's very small, I know. I'm not expecting you to read all of that. I'll make this available if you want to look at the details. But we have approximately 3 million orphans in this country. 3 million approximately orphans in this country. Okay? 650,000 of those approximately are in the foster care system. And that means the others are not. Okay? And this is a growing group within the country. And within that context, we also see a massive growth in violence against women and children and orphans included in that group of children. Okay, so in our country, we sit in a situation that is very strange. That in the past year, or I'm lying, in 2015, if you look at, let me just find the right stat there, adoption has almost disappeared in this country. If you look at the second last bullet point. The number of adoptions has reduced by more than 50% in the past 10 years, with only 1,168 adoptions taking place in 2015. So we live in a country where 3 million orphans exist and fewer than 2,000 adoptions took place in this country. Okay. So as you can see, the national crisis we sit with, next one please, Andrew, is massive. And I think it's important to recognize that when we speak about abortion. Okay? It is not a simple issue in this country. And I know many people who are in favor of abortion in South Africa, also based on very pragmatic arguments. Okay? They will use these statistics to say why abortion should be freely available and should be practiced massively. And I think added to that is the personal complexity of many people's lives. Because when we look at those stats, it's very easy to lose the individuals within that. We find people who are in impossible situations, who are 12 years old, who have been raped, who now have a baby inside of them, who have to take a decision on what to do next. They don't have enough food to eat themselves, but now they must decide what to do next. And I think if we lose sight of that when I make the next few arguments, that would be a massive mistake. So let me be clear, let Marianne and I be clear. We think that these issues are extremely serious and they should be addressed. But we do ask the question, whether, next one please, Andrew, whether abortion is the answer to that. Because if abortion is then used to solve that problem, it should be equated to something close to euthanasia. That is not an outreach organization, by the way, in Asia, right? Okay, if you don't know what euthanasia is, it's killing someone out of humanitarian reasons, from a humanitarian perspective. That's why you kill them. Okay? They might be too sick or in too much pain or something like that, and therefore you put them out of their misery. That would be euthanasia. But we would either have to call abortion euthanasia, or it has to be some sort of birth control method if we're going to apply it in the way that I've described right now. And in my personal view and in Marianne's view, that is not the right way for it to be used. Okay, abortion should not be a form of euthanasia, because if you want to understand the slippery slope argument, there is the slippery slope argument. And I'm not going to have time. In the question and answer time, if you want me to go back there, I'm more than willing to engage with anybody about that slippery slope part of it. I don't use the slippery slope just to tar my opponents with an ugly brush, right? But I do think that this is a real slippery slope. If we are going to allow this to be a form of euthanasia, why stop at the end of the womb? Why? I can't see why. What reason would be a good enough reason for us to stop there. And that is massively problematic. And let me also be clear. I do not view abortion as a birth control measure in the normal run of things as a good idea. Okay? And I'll come to that as we move forward. And I think it's also important to say that abortion has massive medical, psychological, and spiritual implications for the mother. People think, and people often say, but you will find mostly men say that, or people who haven't had an abortion, that an abortion is just another operation. It is not. Okay? Statistically speaking, if you go and look at some of the best medical research, it has massive health implications for women and for future for their future pregnancies, very possibly as well. It increases, and I don't know why this is true. I can't tell you why this is true, but this is true. If you go and look at the health research, it greatly increases your risk of cervical, ovarian, liver, and breast cancer. Okay? It has massive possible psychological implications. Yesterday we had Annabelle and Tian's birthday parties. And one of my friends works at ICAS. Do you know ICAS? It's a counseling service that many businesses use. And she said to me, Andre, I counsel many women either before or after an abortion. And I said to her, so does this harm a woman? Does it hurt her? And the answer was almost always yes. Okay? It is a very, very difficult thing also for a woman who actually has an abortion. So, next one, please. Let's go and look at a few fundamental questions about abortion. Because many people, when they speak about abortion, use arguments for why abortion should be or is a good thing and should not be made into something that is that involves too many ethical or moral arguments. Okay, so now I'm going to look at certain questions and certain statements people make when it comes to abortion. I'm going to look at five specific statements that people often use to talk about abortion. And I think it's important to say, and that's my son, Tian. He's one, and he's sitting with a book called Why Pro-Life by Randy Alcorn. It's a really nice book to read if you're interested. Okay? So in the 1960s, when abortion became a massive issue, especially in the States, and a little bit before that and a little bit after that, we knew certain things about in utero, what happens in utero. And we knew quite a few things about what happens to a fetus inside a mother. But since then, many things have changed massively. And those include, for example, imaging technology, embryology, and genetics. We've learned a lot since then. Okay, so of course, one can still make an argument for abortion. But I think there are a few bad arguments that have been used for abortion. And I'm going to point those out and say why I think they're bad arguments. Okay? And I think one would need other arguments if you want to support the idea of abortion. So let's look at some statements. Next one, please. Okay, so in the beginning they said a conceived baby inside or conceived zygote inside a mother, let's use the slightly more correct medical term, is just a clump of cells. That's all it is. Okay? So I'm going to take you on a little tour of the development of a fetus or a zygote inside a mother. I'm going to use about four slides to just give you a bit of a tour of what happens with that little person or that little human being. I'm being prejudicial here, of course. I'm calling it a human being or a person because that's my belief. I think that is the truth. I know people who are for abortion would argue with that. But only the first quote comes from a pro-life or an anti-abortion website. All the others come from medical textbooks. This is just some medical knowledge. But even this first one is quite a medical statement. It's not prejudicial. It is not something I think we can argue with, really. It's just a statement about fact. It says, at the moment of fertilization, a new unique human being comes into existence with its own distinct genetic code. Whereas the heart, lungs, and hair of a woman all share the same genetic code, her unborn child, from the moment of fertilization, has a separate genetic code that is all its own. There is enough information in this tiny zygote to control human growth and development for the rest of its life. That's conception. So let's move a little bit forward. Please, next one, Andrew. That is a picture of a five-week-old fetus. Okay? And this is a statement from A Child is Born, the fourth edition, 2003. And this is an academic textbook where it says, at 5 weeks old, the embryo is well past the stage when it looks like a formless clump of cells. The skin layers are still barely developed, and the tiny body is quite transparent. The head and tail can be distinguished, as well as the heart, the vertebra of the spinal column, and the beginnings of the tiny hand. If you look at that little hand, it's a bit unclear there, but you can actually see the little fingers starting to develop in that little embryo already. That's 5 weeks. Let's jump 1 week forward, please, Andrew. Next one. That's 6 weeks. This comes from the Biology of Prenatal Development from the National Geographic Organization. By 6 weeks, the cerebral hemispheres are growing disproportionately faster than other sections of the brain. The embryo begins to make spontaneous and reflexive movements. Such movements is necessary to promote normal neuromuscular development. A touch to the mouth area causes the embryo to reflexively withdraw its head. Okay? That is 6 weeks. Let's jump forward to 10 weeks. We're going to stop there. This is 8 weeks after fertilization. By the 8th week of pregnancy, every organ is present and in place. 90% of the structures found in an adult human being can be found in this tiny embryo, now called a fetus. Intermittent breathing motions, though there is no air present in the uterus, occurs. This photograph of an 8-week fetus, 10 weeks gestation. If you're not sure why we say that, you're welcome to ask me at the end. I'm now a dad. Now I know what that means. I could never count in weeks my whole life through until my wife became pregnant. It taught me to count in weeks. Guys, if you don't know how to count in weeks, come and talk to me. I'll tell you. Okay, was taken by a medical student in India immediately following the removal of the mother's uterus after she was diagnosed with cervical cancer. Okay, if you can see that is a 8 or a 10-week fetus, depending on how you count. Okay, and as you can see, that is not just a clump of cells. Whatever you want to call that, that is not a clump of cells. My daughter's picture on the first slide was at 12 weeks, where she was 3 centimeters long. So this little baby there is probably 2.5 centimeters long. That big, okay? That big. And that's what you can see of it, right? So if you tell me that what happens inside a mother in South Africa, you can legally have an abortion, if I am correct, up to 13 weeks without any questions being asked. This is 10 weeks, okay? Up to 13, no questions asked, and you can have an abortion. Up to 20 weeks, you can still have an abortion legally, quite easily, relatively not as easily. And then after 20 weeks, it can only happen if there is a threat to life. Those are the laws in our country, okay? But just to be clear, it's not a clump of cells. Whether you agree with abortion or not, you can't say that it's just a clump of cells because it clearly isn't. Next one, please. Is it the woman's body? We often get told that it's the woman's body. And I think we can dispel with this one very, very quickly. I'm giving you 3 arguments here, but I don't think we need to go into too much detail. I'm actually giving you 4. It is a completely separate genetic code. It cannot be the woman's body if it has a completely different genetic code. As a matter of fact, the last bullet will tell you that the woman's body recognizes this new little fetus as something foreign, and it actually has a response, an immune response against that little fetus. Okay? And that's part of the whole pregnancy process. And the baby, to protect itself, or the embryo, to protect itself, secretes a hormone that actually suppresses that immune response in the mother so it doesn't get killed. So it is this balanced immune response. Now, why would the woman's body respond with the immune response if it's part of her body? It wouldn't. Your body doesn't respond, unless you are very ill, to itself with an immune response. We call those immune diseases of sorts. Okay? So it can't be the woman's body. And the other 2 I give you is just to say, if a Chinese zygote is implanted into a Swedish mother, what is that baby going to look like? Chinese. Okay? It's not going to look Swedish. It's just not the way it works. And then the middle one there, it happens sometimes that a fetus dies inside a mother and the mother lives. And other times it happens that the fetus lives and the mother dies, and that fetus can be taken out alive or kept alive. Okay? If it were the same body, that would be impossible. Okay? You're either dead or alive. It's a dead or alive thing. It's not both. Okay? It's just not the way it happens. So it is not the woman's body. We can't use that argument to justify abortion. Next one, please. Is it a women's rights issue? And I think the answer here has to firstly be yes. Abortion is a women's rights issue. But it's not as simple as saying a woman can do with her body what she wants, because even that statement isn't true, although I think in a country like ours, with our complexity, this is a much more difficult one to answer. Is it a women's rights issue? And I do think here it becomes a true moral dilemma where we as Christians have to engage, and we as thinking people have to engage with this issue very deeply to ask, how do we resolve this? But Margaret Sanger, the person who started Planned Parenthood, said, "No woman can call herself free who does not control her own body." Now, in the previous point, I dispelled the myth that a fetus is her body. It's not. Yes, this baby will have to grow inside the mother for 9 months. Yes, it hijacks her body. Yes, in some sense, it's a little parasite. Okay? I accept all of those parts. No problem. But the fact of the matter is, it's not her body. And let me answer Margaret Sanger with Mother Teresa. "Abortion is profoundly anti-woman," said this woman. I'm quoting a woman here who never had a baby. But this is what she says. "3/4 of its victims are women, half babies, and all the others mothers. Okay? And I think if I can correct Mother Teresa, and that's a dangerous thing to do, but let me try. I think women are disadvantaged more because in many countries of the world, abortion is selective based on gender. I don't know of any. There might be one where the boys get aborted, but it's not what happens in most. In India, in China, it's women that get aborted. So if we want to ask the question, is this a women's rights issue? I have to say yes. In a very complex and nuanced way, we're going to have to discuss it as a women's rights issue. Because women are the ones who are often most disadvantaged by abortion. Next one, please. Is it human? Is that little baby or that little embryo or that little zygote, is it human? And I think this is a very important question to answer. Okay? The first part of the answer is, what species is its mother and what species is its father? Human and human. What is that? Has to be. And I don't want to be flippant about this. So please, if I'm looking flippant, I want to apologize. I want to step back and say, no, I don't want to be flippant about this. But honestly, I think that is a very strong argument. If its mom is a human and its dad is a human, it is almost certainly a human. But let's go one step further than that and say, what differentiates a preborn from a newborn? You get the difference, right? A preborn is an embryo or a zygote inside the mother. And a newborn is one that's just been born. What distinguishes them? There are only four real distinguishing characteristics that make them different from each other. The first one is their size. So if we're going to accept the fact that a preborn is not human based on its size, it means your size determines whether you are human. The bigger you are, the more human you are. That's the argument then. I don't think that is acceptable. Okay? I think we're all equally human. It does not matter what size we are. The second one is the level of development. We are saying this baby, this little zygote is not a human being because it hasn't developed far enough yet. That would also imply that a 10-year-old is less human than a 20-year-old. Because a 20-year-old is more developed than a 10-year-old. It is stronger. It has learned a lot of new things. It can do a lot of different things that a 10-year-old can't do. I don't think a 20-year-old is any more human than a 10-year-old. I think that is just a fallacious argument. Okay? The next one is environment. In other words, where you are determines whether you are human or not. If you're inside the mother, you're not human. If you're born, you are human. And that is the legal point. Let me be clear. That is the legal point of view that the high courts have taken in South Africa. Okay? Inside the mother, you're not really human yet. Outside the mother. That would mean inside the house could be human, outside the house could not be human. That comes down to the same thing. It's about position. I think it's a very difficult one for me to accept, and I know the courts are accepting it, so I must be oversimplifying it, and I think I need to be enlightened a bit more maybe on exactly how that argument works. But I find that a difficult argument to accept. And the last one is dependence. The more dependent you are on someone, the less human you are. That's the argument. If you're completely dependent on someone else, you cannot be human. That's the implication of that. Okay? And that means somebody who gets ill and becomes more and more dependent on someone else becomes less and less human. It's just absolutely not true. I want to use stronger terms, but I'm not going to. I just don't think that's true. I think people will tell you when their relatives become ill and become more and more dependent, they see their humanity more, not less. They experience them as human beings more, not less. And as a matter of fact, I think the more needy someone is, the more attention they should get and the more love they should get, not less. More. That's what they should be getting, is what I would argue. Okay. Next one, please. I think it is human. I think you cannot argue that it's not human. And then is it a meaningful life? Since we've moved forward with embryology and with imaging, I think it has become much more difficult for people to argue for abortion. And the newer arguments for abortion are all based on the fact that, is this a meaningful life? Is this meaningful? And this big picture at the bottom is one I took when I visited Auschwitz with Marianne. Those are pictures of people who were slaughtered in Auschwitz. I'm not saying abortion is the same as Auschwitz, although I think one could possibly say a few things that would call out some similarities. But I can tell you, none of those people who were killed in Auschwitz were seen as human beings in the true sense of the word. They were not seen as meaningfully contributing to society by the people who killed them. Okay? The fact of the matter is, powerful people decide whose life is meaningful and whose life is not. And that is a very dangerous thing when that starts happening. And that has happened in many places in the world before, and and it's something we should be very careful of. When powerful people decide when a life is meaningful and when it's not. And then people use things, people like Peter Singer use things like capabilities and capacities to say whether someone's life is meaningful. Okay? He will say that a dolphin is actually more valuable than a newborn child. Okay? Because that dolphin has more capabilities and capacities than this child. Or an argument about personhood. When does someone become a person? I'm not going to go into those arguments in too much depth right now. If you want to engage on some of those in the question and answer time, I'm more than willing to do so. Okay? But I don't think that is a good approach for us to take, to ask when a life is meaningful. I think it is very dangerous. Because we've had in the past with specific groups, whether you go to Rwanda, or whether you go to Auschwitz, where people have decided whose lives are meaningful and whose are not. And it always ends horribly for the ones whose lives are not seen as being meaningful. Very dangerous in my view. And once again, leads almost inescapably to some sort of slippery slope. Okay? In my view. And once again, I'm willing to defend that if we need to get back to that. So, let me end this part of my talk, and then I want to move to a tentative Christian response. With something I was taught, and I'm quoting the Catholics here, have you noticed? I've quoted Mother Teresa. I'm now going to use something that Peter Kreft taught me, which I found very, very useful. Peter Kreft said, basically, we sit with a quadrilemma. We sit with four possible choices here, only four, when it comes to what happens in utero when we do an abortion. And those four have different levels of culpability, okay? The first possibility is if we know what happens inside the womb is not human, and we know that, and we kill it, then there is no culpability. There is no guilt. There is nothing that we've done wrong. And here I want to be very careful. I'm not accusing anybody of anything, but I think this is what we have to understand. This is where the meat of the issue resides. Okay? If it's not human and we know it, we can kill it. No problem. We do it often. Whether it's a mosquito that you slap, or a plant that you pull out, it's not human, and you kill it, and there's no problem with it. Nobody looks at you in disgust, or nobody accuses you of anything. Nobody wants to stop you from doing it. Well, maybe some people want to. I don't know if there are any mosquito lovers out there, but I apologize to you, okay? All right? Let's go to the green one. The second possibility is that it's not human, and we don't know it. So let me use the example Kreft used. Use this. You drive on a dark road as you leave Dialoog tonight. In front of you, you see something in the road, but you don't know what it is. It looks like a piece of cloth, but there might be somebody underneath. You drive over it. Do you? Because if you do, that would be classified in America as criminal negligence. Even if nobody dies, you're acting negligently. Because you don't know if it's a human. Okay? You don't know if it's a human or not. Okay, but it might not be, but you don't know it. Right? So Peter Kreft uses another example. He says, if you're going to fumigate a building, this one, with very, very poisonous substances that will kill everything in this building, including human beings. If you're going to fumigate this building, and you don't go and check if anybody's inside, you just plug the pipe into the door and you start fumigating. And there was nobody inside. Have you been negligent? And he says, of course you have. You should never do that. If you don't know, if it's not human, and you don't know it, you can't act without some form of culpability. Then, this yellowish one at the bottom right, it is human, and we don't know it. So let's say what happens in utero is human, or a person, but we don't know that it's a person, and we kill it. Okay? Then we are guilty of what would be called manslaughter. In other words, you hear some noises in the bushes when you go hunting. It looks like something you can shoot, and you shoot it, and you kill it. What are you guilty of? Manslaughter, if it's a human being that you've killed. It's your friend who walked there with their hat on. Or you hear a noise in that building that you're going to fumigate. You hear a noise, but you think, it's probably just some rats, you know, it's an old building. And you plug in the poison, and you kill everything inside the building. And when you go inside, there's a dead human being inside. You are guilty of manslaughter, okay? But you didn't know there was a human being inside, but you have just killed a human being. And then the last one, it's human and we know it. It's human and we know it. Okay? And that's the quadrilemma Peter Kreft sketches out. And I'm going to stop there with that, and I want to move to a Christian reaction or a Christian response to this. I think as Christians in this country, we have kept quiet for for specific reasons. But let's move on to that Christian response. And let's start by saying, in the world in which Christianity was born, life of small children and fetuses was not valued at all. Let's be clear. Whether you go to the Romans, whether you go to a cottage in Africa, wherever you went, to Egypt, babies were not valued and were not seen as valuable. And if abortion was possible, obviously the medical technology did not exist, but abortion still took place in a variety of different ways, and it was not in any way seen as morally repugnant. As a matter of fact, in Rome, when a little girl was born and the parents didn't want her, they dropped her on the garbage dump. And maybe somebody picked her up, but otherwise she would die. And nobody went to look for the parents, nobody said anything about them, and the whole world in which Christianity was born, that was the standard practice. And Christians distinguished themselves in that world by starting to pick some of those babies up, by starting to forbid the members of the church to do that, to say, no ways, if you have a baby, it's yours, you must take care of it. And Christianity, whether you like it or not, reformed Western society, at least in this regard, and was one of the main influences in changing our view of the value of children, small children, and then also preborn children. And over the years, Christians have helped influence society. But as society has changed over the past 100 years especially, Christians have become quite responsive in quite interesting ways. And I think some of those ways have been good, some have been bad, and some have been ugly. And you'll see some of those responses pictured there on the side. We've been shouting and screaming at people. We've been protesting. In places like the U.S., people have killed abortion doctors in the name of Christ. I don't know. I mean, that's a conversation for another night. But that's happened. But then we also have people like Dr. Martin Luther King, who said things like, whom you would change, you must first love, and they must know that you love them. And I think Christians have also responded in that way over time. But I think where we are now as a church, we are challenged again, in South Africa especially, but I think throughout the Western world at least, but throughout much broader parts of the world than that, we are challenged again to ask the question, what is the Christian response to all of these little babies that are being born and who are abandoned on rubbish heaps, as they are in South Africa too? What is our response to what is happening inside the womb, and how should we respond in ways to these mothers and to these children? And that is a much more difficult question to answer. And I think we need to start with a Christian view of life. And let me be very clear. I don't think you can have a biblical view of the value of life that differs much from what I'm going to say now. I think you're going to struggle to defend it biblically. I mean, you can hold it personally. I'm not saying you can't hold it personally. But I do think you're going to struggle to defend it biblically. Okay, so can we go to the next one, please? The first thing Christians believe is that human beings were created in the image of God, the Imago Dei. We were created to be representatives of God in this world. Not gods in of ourselves, but created in His image. And in that sense, bearing the value that God has bestowed on human beings. And as a result, all people carry the image of God in them. Whether they are severely disabled, whether they are small or big, whether they are old or young, they carry the image of God within them. That is what Christians have always believed. And that means all human life is valuable in the Christian perspective. All of it. Every single bit of it. And as a matter of fact, if you go and look at the history of human rights that have become so ubiquitous, that you find everywhere, human rights is everything, and it's a good thing. But where does that come from? If Christianity is not true, if there is no image of God in us, if we are just further evolved animals, just that, and I'm not talking about evolution now, I'm just saying if that is all we are, why would we have any other rights than any other animal? And that is Peter Singer's argument. Go and read him. His argument is, if God does not exist, if we are not created in the image of God, we basically are just all animals. And then we should all be treated the same. And he makes quite an interesting and a strong argument in that sense. But human rights should then not exist. And it's also interesting, if you go and read your Bible, to see how life, and even preborn life, is handled in the Bible. Whether it is in the Psalms, where God says, I knew you in your mother's womb. I knitted you together in your mother's womb in the Psalms. Whether it's the Old Testament laws, which many people these days denigrate and say, you know, the Old Testament laws are also unsophisticated, etc. Have you read them? Some of them are a bit strange for our palate at the moment. I would fully agree. But some of them are fascinating. The Old Testament speaks about a woman who is pregnant, who gets bumped accidentally, and the baby dies inside of her. What is that man guilty of? Go and read it. Okay? Right? The Old Testament speaks about the unborn baby. And then we find John and Jesus reacting to each other in utero in the New Testament. Did you know that? Okay? When the pregnant mother comes, John moves inside his mother. Okay? Go and read that. So there is talk of in utero reaction, even not contact quite, between John and Jesus. But the fact of the matter is, the Christian perspective is one that where all human life is valued. It should not be taken unless it has to be taken. And all humans have the same rights and should have the same rights. We can go to the next one, please. So, what do I think? Now, I've only got two slides on this and then two more slides with one quote and one text on it. And then I'm basically done and you can start roasting me if you want to. But what should be a Christian response? The first thing I think we have to say to each other is that we should stop ignoring this, recognize the seriousness of the issue of abortion and the whole crisis in our country of orphans. We should recognize this as Christians. And we should take it really seriously as the early church did. Because Jesus taught us as Christians. He showed us to stand up for the oppressed, for the defenseless, for the weak. As Christians, those are the people we should be standing for. Those are the people we should be defending. Those who cannot defend themselves. Those who cannot take care of themselves. Because we all owe all people our love. And I want to stop there for a moment and say that includes people who've had abortions. That includes people who actually do abortions. What we do not have an option about as Christians is that we should owe all people love. All of them. Every single human being. It is not for us to judge, no. But it is for us to interact and get involved and make a difference. In love, of course, we should be doing that. I also think it's important for us to get involved in the related matters that complicate what happens in our country. Let me say, as middle-class Christians, most of us would fall in that category. Do we take poverty seriously enough? Are we actually taking this seriously enough that this should stop? People should not be living as they are living. The things that are happening to especially women in this country should not be happening. Where are the voices of us as Christians to stand up about these things? We should be involved in alleviating this. We are the salt and the light. And I think those national complexities I spoke about are things that should be addressed and the Christians should be on the forefront, and that includes me. One of the reasons why this was such a difficult talk for Marianne and I to take on is because it challenged us fundamentally in terms of our own involvement in communities of poor people with orphaned children. Should we be adopting is the question we had to ask ourselves. We are still busy grappling with that. We're not planning to dad, okay? So don't worry about it yet, okay? But we have to ask ourselves, if we're going to talk about abortion, Marianne and I, should we not be asking ourselves whether part of the solution is not for us to pick up a baby that is important to Christ that is lying on a rubbish heap somewhere? Is that not what we should be doing if we're going to be talking about abortion? Okay. And this has been very difficult for us because of these complicating factors. And I do think it does not mean I'm going to say tonight and try and argue that everybody here should be adopting a baby. Okay? So that's what I'm saying. But I do think this is the sort of crisis that we should be counted as being part of solving. We should not stand on the sidelines and ignore this. We should be involved as Christians because this is such a serious issue. And I do think there are some real moral dilemmas. You know what a real moral dilemma is, right? A true moral dilemma is when somebody comes knocking at your door and it's a woman and she's running away and she's really out of breath. She's saying, my husband is chasing me with an axe. He wants to kill me. Please hide me in the living room. And you take her in, you put her in the living room. 3 minutes later, knock on the door. You stand there, there's a guy with an axe. Have you seen a woman? Now that's a true moral dilemma. You're either going to lie, or you're going to give her access to him, and him to her, and he's going to kill her with an axe. Should you lie? Of course you should. In a true moral dilemma, you have to choose between two evils and you choose the one that will bring the greater good. That's what you have to try and do in a true moral dilemma. And I think when we talk about abortion, I have to accept the fact that there are some true moral dilemmas in here. But one of them is not, in my view, whether this is a baby and whether this baby should be protected inside the mother as far as possible. So, next one, please. I'm almost done. Let me make it slightly more personal. I want to challenge everybody in Dialuach, and I know you're already involved in places like Tembisa, etc. I don't know what your life circumstances are. But let me tell you, this talk has challenged the Fonseil family who live in Benoni. It has challenged us so much. Because we can't talk about something which we don't believe in. We can't. I would rather not come to Dialuach if I had to do that. Okay? And I think it is time that we ask ourselves, what can I do about this massive mess? And I'm not just talking about abortion. This mess our country is in. What can I do? My question to you is, are we acting and living as if all human life is important enough for Christ to have given his life to save? Is that what we're doing? Are we acting in that way? Because I think that is the call on our lives as Christians. And I want to tell you, I don't know if anybody in this room has had an abortion. I don't know. But I want to tell you, if you've had, if you know somebody who has had one, please don't see any judgment from me. Okay? Please make sure you get the counseling that you need. Please make sure that you get well again. Please make sure you come to a point where you, if you need to, can forgive yourself and get forgiveness from God if you think that is what you need. I really would want to just ask you to make sure you get well again. Okay? So that you can be loved in the church and that you can be part of the solution. And then the last thing I want to just quickly say to those of you who are married or not married and also using birth control methods, one of the other things that has challenged us, me and my aunt, is when we started reading about this, we started reading about birth control methods. And you will not believe how many commonly used birth control pills do not stop conception. It stops implantation. And let me tell you, my wife has told me, I'm not taking those. If we're not going to have another baby, we're not going to not have another baby using those. Okay? Be critical. If you're a Christian, you're going to be thoughtful about life. If life starts at conception, if you accept those things, you need to also be questioning exactly how you are running your life. And I'm not against birth control at all. I'm just saying, don't just accept what you're being told. Check it out, because I think it has moral implications. Okay, my second to last slide. This is Mother Teresa again. And I don't want to be harsh, but I think she puts it beautifully. She says, I feel the greatest destroyer of peace today is abortion, because it's a war against the child. And if we can accept that a mother can kill even her own child, how can we tell other people not to kill one another? How do we persuade a woman not to have an abortion? As always, we must persuade her with love. And we remind ourselves that love means to be willing to give until it hurts. To me, that is a beautiful summary of the Christian position. Okay? And then the last one from the Bible. This is the Amplified Version of Romans 12, verse 1 to 2. It says, therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies, dedicating all of yourselves set apart as a living sacrifice, holy and well-pleasing to God, which is your rational, logical, and intelligent act of worship. And do not be conformed to this world any longer with its superficial values and customs, but be transformed and progressively changed as you mature spiritually by the renewing of your mind, focusing on godly values and ethical attitudes, so that you may prove for yourselves what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect in his plan and purpose for you. I want to just pray for us, and then we'll open the floor to questions. Lord Jesus, I have had a lot to say tonight. And I want to ask that you will forgive me if I've hurt anybody in the process. I want to ask that you will bring healing also through what we've said today. That you will bring information, yes, but more importantly, that through your Spirit and through the work of Jesus on the cross, that you will bring healing to people sitting in this church, but also through these people sitting in this church, to people outside of this church. And broader than that, Lord Jesus, we are a nation in need of healing. We are a nation in need of recuperation. We need recovery. We need this country to become a place where people are not just worshiping you on Sunday, but where they are worshiping you with their lives in everything that we do, where women and children are safe and protected. where things like rape and incest and molestation do not happen, where it's a safe place again for people to live, and where it's also a safe place for a fetus to be inside its mother's womb. Please help us, Lord Jesus, to make this true. And if I want to just specifically pray for anybody in this room who's been hurt through abortion, whether they've had it themselves or somebody close to them has had it, will you please, through your Spirit, minister to them? And if I've hurt them tonight, please expunge my words from their memory. Don't let them remember it. Come and minister to them through your Spirit so that there may be healing for them too. I pray all of these things in the name of Jesus Christ, because He is the one who came to save all of us. Amen. Just before I open the floor to questions, can I just have the last slide there, please, Andrew, before Marianne comes back to me and says, I didn't do it. Marianne, can you hear on the recording? There it is. Those are just some resources that we found helpful on the internet. Okay, so in South Africa, we found africacaresforlife.org.za, extremely helpful, positive, winsome, not trying to hurt people through this, but a very, very good one. And specifically in Benoni, where we live, there's something called Life Choices Benoni, which was very helpful. And on the right-hand side, those are more American ones, but they're very, very good. So prolifetraining.com, equalrightsinstitute.com, and Life is Best TV. All of those are training resources that are aimed at training people how to interact with others on abortion. StephanieGray.info is just a specific person who's created her own website. Also, training related, but also some personal stories. And then abort73 and abortionfacts.com are both very good, but much more factual. They're not existential to the same degree. They're very much argument-based, okay? But not explicit or trying to manipulate people. It's about the arguments that they're trying to make much more apologetic, those last two, than the others. Okay, so I think I need to give this mic over and see if there are any questions people want to ask or comments.
Hi. I was just wondering about the Zika virus.
Yep.
And because I've seen a lot of it on the news, and the babies are
deformed,
incredibly
yeah.
deformed. What's your view on that? Because it's a sticky wicket for me.
Yeah, no, look, I think it's one of those places I'm going to express a personal view. But I do think good Christian people can, in good conscience, argue different points of view. Marianne and I have had two kids, and one of the things they do is they do Down syndrome testing and a few other tests for deformities. And we asked ourselves beforehand, what do we do if it comes back positive? And for us, the answer was nothing. We continue with this pregnancy. This is a life of a human being, and we are not the ones to decide how valuable that life is. We'll make this life as valuable as we can. So for me, the answer would still be to continue with that baby, but I would not force that on somebody. So if you had to ask me how I think the law should be, I don't think it should be permissible as a birth control method. But if a baby is severely deformed or a mother is in danger, I think the law should possibly allow it. But I think that person should do it with a lot of counseling and a lot of prayer to know what they're doing. That is very difficult. So,
from what I've seen, those babies don't really stand a chance of
yes.
what we would term a normal life.
Yes.
I think we're going to have to wait and see how they grow up.
Yes.
Is it fair on that child? Because I'd like to just say this as well, is my sister had to have an abortion. It was a medical emergency.
Yes.
And I got a a vision that same day after it happened.
Mm. Sure. Take your time. No rush. Okay, we'll come back to you in a moment. I really would like you to complete that, if that is okay. Okay, let's just give him a moment, Harman, to compose himself, and then if he wants to, I'd love for him to continue. So, okay, anybody else?
Sorry, just a thing that I'd like to understand a little bit better, maybe, is like what really, in your view, causes abortion?
What causes it?
I know it sounds like a stupid question,
I know.
But... But the thing is, effectively, like in America,
yes.
if abortion was counted as a cause of death, it would be the leading cause of death.
Yes, absolutely.
One-seventh of the American population has been aborted.
Hmm.
you know, who are living today, the argument oftentimes is, you know, like whenever you engage in these things, the first thing out the barrel are basically like rape, incest,
yes.
You know, those kinds of things. I mean, statistically, it's actually very, very low there.
Yes, so when like those things happen, yes.
In places like those where the definition of poverty is, you know, is counted in how many air conditioners your house has.
Yes.
You know.
So what are you asking me?
Why? Why does it happen then? What is the...
Look, once again, I would want to... there's a very good quote by Mother Teresa I would have loved to put up there, where she basically says, for our comfort, you know? And I want to be very careful here, because when I say that, that small proportion of people who don't do it for their comfort, but out of absolute desperation, I think it has become an acceptable way of birth control for people, you know? They see it as a way of birth control. I don't want this baby at the moment. I'm not ready for this baby at the moment, and therefore the baby is, as it's called, terminated, whatever that may mean. Okay, so I'm not sure if I'm answering you, but I think that is often the case in a place like the U.S., but also in South Africa that happens, but it's less. If you go and look at those stats in the States, it is not the poorest of the poor who have the most abortions. In South Africa, that is the group with the most abortions, the poorest of the poor. I'm not saying that makes it good. Please don't get me wrong. But I do think in a country like that, it has become for a middle class to rich group of people a way of managing their lives, you know? So it's a birth control.
Okay, and yeah, so I don't know if it's serendipity or what, but I mean, literally, like on Friday, somebody works for me, like she asked for some days off, basically, and she actually like went to go get an abortion, but she couldn't get one.
Okay.
So the morning I like asked her, listen, you know, why were you out and stuff, and I asked her straight up why that was and stuff. I wouldn't say I necessarily dealt with it very well.
Of course.
But like the first barrage of arguments were economic, and those were sort of like put out of the way. You know, unfortunately, the comfort stuff came
out.
Yes,
like, absolutely.
And I mean, in her case, like, I don't know if she went for the thing today.
Look, if I could ask you to try and get her to get in contact with Life Choices in Benoni. These are people who will give her alternatives, will tell her what else is possible, you know. I think this is one of the most valuable things we can do as Christians, to engage with conversation, but not you necessarily, because you're not in the right position to do that or trained to do that necessarily. But I think if we could start encouraging people to get good advice, you know, that'll make a big difference. Because I think every specific case of abortion, you'd probably be able to trace, not probably, you'd certainly be able to trace a story behind that, you know. And I think we should just be careful not to make people two-dimensional and to demonize them for this specific thing. Although I do think that's not happening at the moment. I don't think we're in danger of demonizing them. We're just in danger of ignoring them to do whatever they like, you know. And I think that is more dangerous than demonizing them almost. So thank you for talking to her, you know. And I think it would be great for her to get some good advice.
Life Choices Benoni.
Well, or that one above it, the Africa Cares for Life. They will have contact centers. It depends on where you are. There will be good people in Pretoria. We just don't know who they are. But there will be some good people who would be willing to sit down with her and talk to her and make sure she gets proper counseling. And then she can still decide to do what she wants. Nobody wants to coerce her, but we want her to have an informed decision.
Yeah, sorry, just on another thing that I thought of as well that I find, you know, like, talk about the moral dilemma, basically. I mean, if I was in Mainland and somebody was dangling a child over the side, and I mean,
yes,
you know, any and all forms of violence against
yes.
that person would be justified
yes.
to save that child.
Yes.
Like, and I mean, you made the comment about killing the abortion doctor, which is, again, like, the person with the axe, basically.
Yes, yes. Okay, but can I just come back to you on that one?
Yeah.
I do think... I do think there is an argument that could be made in that direction, and those people make that argument. But I don't think that's what Christians have been called to do in the first place. Okay, so if I can use the analogies of salt and light, that's becoming a spotlight, and that's becoming too much salt in the food. Okay, it's not going to solve the issue in the long run. I think that the main thing Christians have to do is to start influencing society again, so that they understand what's happening when this is taking place, so that we can change society. That does not mean I am judging even those Christians. I don't think we should be killing anybody. I don't think we're called as Christians to start by doing that. Because that person killing the abortion doctor is not saving a life directly that's happening in front of them there. The example you're using is a much stronger example. Okay? But they're waiting for them outside the clinic and they're murdering them, basically. Okay? I don't think that is what Christians are called to do. And even that person over the edge, I think as a Christian, your first call is obviously to save that baby. But if you at all can save that dad or that person as well, you should. Your first call should not be to take out your gun and shoot them and try and catch the baby. You know, that's not the way it should be. So I just think as Christians, we are called to take care of all life. And we are called. It's happened often that people who have been involved in abortions have come to other insights and have actually become anti-abortion activists. You know, and I think we have a lot of work to do to try and make people understand what abortion is. Understand that it's, I'm going to just be blunt here. It's anti-poor. It's anti-black. It's anti-women. I can make that argument, let me tell you, because the most babies that get aborted are black, poor women. That's who it's against. Okay? Those are the people getting killed. So that might not be politically correct to say, but I think the statistics will support me. And those are the most vulnerable people who are already being harmed in our society. Should they not be protected for crying in a bucket? You know? So I don't know, I've gone a little bit off the farm here, but I think you and I could have a long conversation. I just don't think that's what we're called for, to be soldiers for God with machine guns waiting for people at abortion clinics. I don't think that's what we're called for, unless we don't have a choice. You know, that's the last resort. Anybody else?
I just wanted to ask, fertilized eggs that are stored,
yes.
Do you think they are not yet, they're not yet fetuses, are they?
Look, massive arguments are made. So does everybody understand the question? So in in vitro fertilization, they fertilize like 10 eggs or 12 eggs or 15 eggs, and then they only implant a certain number of those, and the rest that stay behind are those persons. I think that is another night's talk. I want to literally go as far as that, because I think in vitro fertilization, but I think if we believe that life starts at conception, at least we have to say that it's problematic. We're going to have a long conversation, because that argument rests on the idea that a fertilized egg is not a human yet. It must implant first on the mother's womb, then it becomes human. So what people who make that argument do is they say, until implantation takes place, we don't have a human being yet. I'm not sure that that's a viable argument in my view. So I find that problematic. I'm not against in vitro. Please don't get me wrong. I'm just saying, be careful. Birth control. Thank you. I think Christians who get involved with things like in vitro must just do it thoughtfully. Okay? Because I do think there is some real moral issues there. Sorry, I interrupted you. You want to?
The other thing I wanted to ask is, I met a Russian lady, and she said her mother, I think it was in the time of communism, they basically, as you said, used this as, abortion as birth control.
Yes, yes.
She had like
30
abortions.
Yes, yes.
So what happens to the person? Does she become, very hard?
Look, I've not looked at that, so I'm going to have to guess. All I can tell you is that there is very good evidence that one of the victims of an abortion is the mother. So let me just make that clear. There are very few people who can come through an abortion without any harm to themselves. Very few. I'm sure it can happen, but I think it's relatively rare. And I mean, in places like China with a one-child policy, you don't want to hear the stories that come out of places like that. Okay, on both infanticide and abortion. So I just think those countries like those do not take a Christian view of the value of any human life. And as a result, I mean, let's also be clear. Margaret Sanger supported, and I don't want to go and slate her, but in the time in which Margaret Sanger started Planned Parenthood, something like eugenics was massive. In other words, planning societies, who should live and who should die. We should make society become a better place. Dumb people should die, clever people should live, you know? And let me be clear again. Black people should die or not have so many kids, and white people should have more kids, okay? All of those were part of the eugenics movement. Now, we should be very careful looking back at history, because in 30 years, they're going to look back at us and think, those ignoramuses, you know, what did they know? Look at what dumb things they thought was true. So I'm not trying to look back with what G.K. Chesterton calls chronological snobbery eyes. I'm not trying to look back and say, look how stupid people were. I'm just saying that we, in Auschwitz, one of the things that's up there, he says, be careful not to forget history, something to that effect, because you will repeat it. When you walk into Auschwitz, that's one of the first things, you know. Remember history so that you do not repeat this. And I just think we should continue doing that. Remember history so we don't make the same mistakes about humans that have been made in the past. We have a horrible history about taking care of weak and poor people. Okay, anybody? There were some more. Okay, yes.
Hi. I'm not sure how I'm going to phrase this question, so I'm just okay.
Go for it.
Going to try. So on the issue of pro-life and pro-choice,
yes.
Where do you stand and where do you think Christians should stand? Because pro-choice to me sounds like, okay, from a law level, people should be able to have the choice, right? And from a pro-life perspective, it's like people shouldn't have a choice. Abortion shouldn't happen, right?
Yes.
And how, as Christians, are we supposed to respond? Are we supposed to be pro-life? Or is it our job rather to, everything you've been saying about loving people through whichever choices they make. Yes. Is it our choice to force people to not have a choice?
Okay. So if your question is what should be legal, that is a different question. And I think that would be an interesting discussion for us to have. I think as Christians, I don't think you need to take the two, let's call it a false dichotomy between pro-life and pro-choice that has been sketched in America. I think your response needs to be thoroughly Christian. And I mean, there are some pro-life people who are thoroughly Christian, and I'm sure there are some true Christians in the pro-choice group too, people who are really, who love Christ. But I think you need to ask yourself, and that's why I put up the last verse from Romans 12, verse 1 to 2. I think what should lead us is the Spirit of God and what Christ has done. Okay, so I personally do not think that our country did the right thing to make abortion as freely available as it is, although I understand the complexities of our society. Okay? But I do think it has had very, very bad implications. I'm not pro-life or pro-choice. I am pro-Christ. And I'm pro-a Christian perspective. And I'm not trying to cop out because I think I nailed my colors to the mast here. I am against abortion unless it's really, really necessary. Let me be clear about that. But that does not mean I am judging people or I'm going to try and force my views onto society. I think as Christians, we are back to where Christianity started. We're living in a time where this has become an acceptable practice. We should be salt and light. We should start picking up these children. We should start picking up these mothers. We should start reinforcing people and telling them again how much they are worth because Christ died for them. Every single one of them, even the one inside someone's womb, is that valuable that Christ died for them. Let us protect that life. Let's encourage people to do that. So I would say that we need to find new ways to change society again. That would be, for me, the Christian answer. And that could involve things like pro-life activities. But I'm not saying we should all get involved in pro-life. I do think we should encourage people not to have abortions where at all possible. And we should help those who've had them who are hurt. Those are things I feel strongly about. Okay.
Should rape victims be expected to have the child that was conceived during the attack?
Sure. Okay. That is one of those almost impossible questions to answer. Okay? I think it actually is one of the true moral dilemmas because I do think there are instances where rape victims have carried babies to full term and where it's been the right thing. I also think there are instances where this could cause massive psychological harm to the woman. And it could re-harm and re-harm and re-harm her. And now we have to choose between two bad things. Terminating the pregnancy or killing the baby or whatever you want to call it. Or forcing this woman to be harmed over and over and over again until a point of possible breakdown. Okay. And I do think that should be permissible in law if you were to ask me. And I do think it needs to go with a lot of counseling, a lot of prayer, a lot of love. And then the best possible decision must be taken, and that person must be loved for that decision. That's my answer. Okay? I'm copping out because I don't think a rule is going to work in a true moral dilemma. I think we need to be sensitive, prayerful, open to the leading of the Spirit of God, and in all instances, loving. Okay?
Yeah, I just want to first start by apologizing for coming in a bit late. Maybe
not at all.
It was not even going to be necessary for me to ask. I'm just worried about the level of silence in the media about abortions.
Yes.
We always told about teenage pregnancies. They'll give us figures here and there. But I don't know as to whether it's me, but I've never really come across statistics, more especially for South Africa, that relate to more especially teenage abortions. I'm worried about that. There's a lot of silence about what is going on in the abortion arena. We just know that abortion is now freely available, but the impression that I've got where I stand is that nobody wants to tell us how many young people out there commit abortion every year. We are only told about teenage pregnancies and the mortality rates and so on. I would really be very much interested to know exactly how many of our children go for abortions.
Okay, so I can tell you that those stats are being kept and they are freely available if you were to Google them, but you'll not find them reported in any media houses because they are not seen as shocking or negative. They are seen as achievements. Okay, so I don't think the media sees that as news, to be honest. If you want to have access to those, we've found them relatively easily, and I will gladly point you to them. They're not perfect because our especially public health system do not keep very good records in all instances. In some they do, but in some they don't keep the best of records. That means we're not perfect, but we've got a relatively good sense. I didn't bring those with. I can't remember on that one slide of stats whether there were some on that. The second one about the context. I can't remember if I had the abortions on there. If you could go back to that, Andrew, that'd be great. So it might be on there. Otherwise, I'll give you my email address at the end. You can mail me, and I'll put you in contact with the right places to see what's going on. Is it there? Okay. I don't know if he wants to come back, Herman. Oh, sorry, I don't. Not. Okay, that's fine. Anybody else? Last chance? Okay. Then thank you very much for being willing to listen to me tonight. I have already prayed for us to end off. I don't know if anybody's going to close from Dialoog's side, but I think we'll end there. Thank you.